It's wonderful to have you all join us this morning for our second day on leading into the common good in Anabaptist perspective. Yesterday, I was able to recognize some of the staff from our graduate and professional studies division that have organized things. Today, I want to add some of the ACRS folks who have done a tremendous amount of behind-the-scenes work as well. And tomorrow, we'll be recognizing the planning committee for the content. But particularly want to recognize Terry Burkholder, who's standing in the back, who coordinated transportation and many other things. Lee Yoder, who organized the chapel celebration that we'll be having at 10 o'clock. And all of the ACRS folks, if you all could just stand where you are so people know who's part of the ACRS contingent. And let's thank them. Thank you. So this morning we're going to be focusing on leadership in the context of community, which is a particularly salient discussion for Anabaptists. Peter Block will be joining us from Cincinnati in about 10 minutes. He's actually participating now. He's able to hear and see our conversation. You will shortly see him as well. But it's my privilege now to introduce another person from Cincinnati. And that is Malia Watkins. Malia is a Goshen student. She is a senior. And she has enjoyed her 4 years there at Goshen. She said her particular passion is soccer and track. And her major is in marketing. Had the privilege of having dinner with Malia and some other students last night. And it was really clear as we interacted with students from various colleges and universities that there are remarkable students, not just at EMU, but at other of our Mennonite colleges as well. So please welcome Malia. Thank you.
Hello, how are you guys? Okay, so I'll be talking today about why community matters for millennials. And I feel this is something that not a lot of people exactly know, but they kind of get a gist of it. So a few days ago, I went onto my Facebook, as a millennial, I always do, and I saw this article from BuzzFeed titled, 48 Reasons 90s Kids Had the Best Childhood, which we did, and I immediately clicked it. This article literally made me giggle from all the memories I had. So when I think of what it means to be a millennial, I don't usually think of all the technological advances that have happened through our time period. I think of how I used to love watching Rugrats faithfully, how I played Sonic on my PlayStation, or how I went to the Scholastic Book Fair just to see the Guinness Book of World Records. And for many millennials, this is what community is all about, being able to share all of these fond memories with someone. As a generation, we went through constant change, from the invention of the internet to the creation of social media. And because of this, we needed a community that understood what we've been going through. Our sense of community has expanded beyond our neighbors. It has become the whole world. When I was looking up statistics about millennials, I found something really cool, weird, and extremely true. 65% of millennials say losing their phone or computer would have a greater impact than losing their car for their daily routine. I would have to say I have freaked out looking for my phone. I've not been very rational looking for it. I've torn my covers off, crawled under my bed, and pretty much disassembled my entire room just to find my phone. Our phones are so important because it links us to our communities everywhere. And it does it in an instant. And we've grown up knowing this, so we use it to the best of our abilities. Technology has enabled us to have these several communities and to communicate with them every day. And it also allows us to organize each one by a certain niche. Thinking back through my life, my definition of community has changed many times. I started out with those around my neighborhood playing hopscotch or riding bicycles down the big hill. But then those kids moved away. Then I began connecting with other people on a site called Neopets. And for people who know that what that is, it's kind of embarrassing to say. It is a website that allows you to raise virtual pets and fight them in little battles. Then MySpace popped into my life after that, and that was when I started trying to take selfies by turning the camera around my phone and trying to make sure I can get my head in the photo. And so that was the largest struggle we've had since before selfies were created. Now my community is defined by the people at Goshen College, my hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio, and my friends and family on Facebook and other social media. As we've grown older, we've started to believe that we can change the world. According to the Huffington Post, 61% of millennials are worried about the state of the world and feel personally responsible. We use our power of technology to share information and organize against or for certain causes. It has become easier to find like-minded people and for us to encourage action from people around the world. Without this sense of worldwide community, we would not have been able to make an impact. Because we believe so strongly in community and doing what is right, we recently were able to change the hiring policy at Goshen College to make it more accepting of LGBTQ people, which was a very large deal to Mennonite institutions because of our connection with the Mennonite Church. Along with our need for social change, we have grown up with different expectations from ourselves and others. Now it is a common thing to be college educated so that you can go on to do amazing things. With this expectation though, we have created a stipulation that our ethics have to align with the company that we choose after graduation, and it also must be socially responsible. We take on thousands of dollars in debt to meet the requirements needed for a job, and then we go into fields that don't offer the higher salaries. We do this all for our communities and to feel that we have done our civic duty. So why does community matter to millennials? It matters because we love remembering the good times and fighting for a better tomorrow together. Thank you.
Well said, Malia, and I'm struck by this sentence. Our ethics have to align with the company or organization we choose to work with after graduation. And that may be one of the reasons that salary levels are a bit lower, as you hinted, but I really admire that commitment. So I'm going to now bring Peter Block onto the screen so you can see his face. And I want to introduce him by mentioning two books that he wrote that have really influenced me. The first is Flawless Consulting. You can see that this is a well-worn book. I started consulting when I worked with Mennonite Conciliation Service in 1986, so it's been about 30 years ago. But what really impressed me about Peter's book on consulting was that he stressed the ethics and values of the consultant, and he stressed knowing where you were in the consulting process. And I realized this is a person who takes ethics and values very seriously and also takes process very seriously. So it's been a very influential book for me. More recently, just last year, a colleague and I required Peter's more recent book, Community, the Structure of Belonging, for a course that we were teaching on developing restorative organizations. And what most impressed me about this book was how Peter framed the role of leaders, which was to create inclusive communities and to provide structures for people to know that they belong in those communities. And the final thing I'll mention is that Peter not only writes well, he lives out his beliefs, and I'm going to read just this paragraph from his bio. Living in Cincinnati, as he does, Peter serves on the boards of directors of Cincinnati Classical Public Radio, Elementes, a hip-hop center for urban youth, and LivePerson, a provider of online engagement solutions. He's also on the advisory board for the Festival and the Workplace Institute, in the Bahamas, and he's the first distinguished consultant in residence at Xavier University. With other volunteers in Cincinnati, Peter began a small group. That's the name of it, a small group, whose work is to create a new community narrative and to bring his work on civic engagement into being. So please join me in welcoming from Cincinnati, Peter Block.
Thank you, David. Nice to see you all. Can you hear me? Yes? All right. That pretty much wraps it up then. I just wanted to make sure I could be heard. So you're important to me. You're Mennonites. You stand for something. Everywhere I go, where I see a sense of democracy breaking out, you know, egalitarian spirit, a sense of caring for the whole, one of you is always in the room. And so I wish I could be with you, but this is as good as it gets. And so I'm just happy, as soon as it's the Mennonite group gathering, talk about the future. I was thrilled to be part of your conversation, which means I can get to the point quicker with you, because you know the community is the point. And what's painful for our Malia and the next generation is we've forgotten the community matters. The last 100 years or so has been to say, let's put the common good aside and let's care about the privatization of almost everything. And so we privatized our schools, we privatized our highways, we privatized our government. And the general conversation has been that we have too much government. Government is that institution who cares for the common good. And we say, let's shrink it. Let's get rid of it. People run for office, and the platform they run is against the office that they're running for. I mean, it makes no sense. We have in a campaign now where none of the conversations makes much sense. And so really the task is to say, how do we reclaim the commons? What kind of leadership allows us to do that? And we do that in the face of a very patriarchal world. Even in your place where you have semicircles, you're still lined up in rows like sardines. And so our typical way of gathering, even though our belief in community is deep and belief in a set of egalitarian values is deep, we still have a habit of kind of orderly, patriarchal, high control ways. And we're looking for leaders. If you take the candidates as a kind of a leader of the moment, basically, their answer is, collect me and I'll take care of you. I'll keep you safe. I'll raise your children. I'll get you jobs. I'll get rid of the 1%. It's so interesting, in this country, we're all, worldwide, we're all part of the 1%. But everybody thinks the 1% is someone else. I'm sure Donald Trump doesn't think he's part of the 1%. And so we have this kind of leadership model of vision, role model. You lead, we will follow. Well, that model is part of what gets us in trouble. It's part of why Malia needs technology to find her community. And so what I really want to talk about is, what would it look like if we had leadership as a convening function? You believe in convening. You're convening now. You come together in conference, come together to face each other and say, what kind of future do we want to create? You come together to heal the woundedness of the breakdown in community. And even faith communities have a hard time coming together. Some of those most political and patriarchal places I know are churches and people of faith. And so the circle is a symbol of an alternative kind of community. And so you say, well, I don't want a parent to lead me. Most of our models are parent-child. And you say, why don't we come together in partnership? Why don't we come together as peers? And that's what you are. That's what you believe in. And so that model of leadership says that vision, role model, charting out a future are not useful. What they do is they take people's agency away from them. And so for most organizations, the model we have is a parent and a child. And I worry more about the child than I do about the parent. Because if a leader stands in front of you and you ask a question, they say, I don't know. You say, what kind of leader are you? If a leader comes in front of you and says, I'm not your father, I'm not your mother. You say, well, that's not what I had in mind. I want you to take care of me. I want you to take us somewhere. And so membership in this modern era has the model of dependency, the model of, well, we're here to follow. And so I think what you're doing as Mennonites is you're reexamining, saying, well, how do we in small groups come together so that everybody's voice is heard? And so it's a convening function. And the purpose is to confront citizens with their freedom, not promise them certain. And most of our leadership models are trying to be nice, but we promise certain. Let me tell you where we're headed. Tell me, leader, where are we headed? And so the community book basically says that the transformation is to engage people in conversations they haven't had before. So if you say, what is a third way? So right now there's a conversation going on about how much control does the top have? How much control does the bottom have? There's always issues that divide, you know, around people's rights and things. I love the notion that for every great idea, the opposite idea is always true. And to me, the Mennonites have been a community who's able to hold that paradoxical nature of the world gracefully and say, well, you feel strongly about that. I see the world differently. There's truth in both sides. Now, what kind of future do we want to create together? Most of the conversations, the old conversation is, there's a right and a wrong. And we need Robert's Rules of Order to decide, let's vote. The alternative conversation is, okay, we see the world differently. How do we face each other and say, well, is there a third way? Is there some way that we can create a future together that's distinct from the past? We have this notion that who we are now is determined by where we've been. I don't believe that. There's a quote I love, which says that in Russia, even the past is unpredictable. Even the past, and I believe that's true. We have this notion that the person is determined by their background, by their history, by their family, by their religion. We've lost the notion of free will. And so in this world of I control, this world of corporatization, we live with the business perspective, which is speed is good. Cost should be low. Things should be larger and bigger. All right, this is a business perspective. It's fine, but it's not the kind of world I want to live in. You're in this conference to slow time down, not to speed it up. Malia loves her technology because it's so efficient. And she's lost without her phone. And to me, I love the phone. But you say, well, leadership has a role to convene people with enough time to engage and get connected to each other and have conversations they haven't had before. And I can tell you what those conversations are. The conversations of possibility. The corporatization of a culture, dominant culture, loves to talk about problems. I can't watch the news anymore. It's too painful. Because all it tells me is there's something wrong with us. And all it's designed to do is to make me afraid. And when people are afraid, they're easier to control. So there's an agenda in the dominant conversation that says that you should be afraid. There's danger out there. And over the years, we've let our children walk fewer and fewer blocks from home and felt comfortable. And so there's been a marketing of fear. And to me, your congregation, your belief system is the alternative for that. The congregation of faith and connection. And so our work is to have a different conversation, which is one of possibility instead of problem. I live in Cincinnati, a dominantly African-American city. And so in the last 14 years, we've done 11 studies on racism. 11 studies. And every study has said, yes, we do have problems with racism. Now, why do we need to do that 11 times? So it tells me that studying problems is a defense against solving. And the idea that I need more data, more information is silly. Now we're on poverty. So a lot of my work is say, well, what do you do about the economic imbalance? Well, the first thing you do is you hire the RAND Corporation. And they come in and do a big study on poverty. I don't need a big study on poverty. All I have to do is drive two blocks away. And so the conversation of problems doesn't take us anywhere. The conversation about race or the top 1% or inequality, I want to have a conversation about prosperity with you. I want to stop calling people poor. As soon as I call you poor, I've labeled you as broken. There's no such thing as a poor person. There's people with no money. And half of us in this room have lived some time in our life with no money. It's a real conversation of deficiency. So part of what leadership can do is say, let's talk about gifts. Let's talk about capacities. Let's talk about possibility. And everything changes. So I would say that the leadership role is to convene people in small groups. And in those small groups, make sure they're composed of strangers, because the dominant culture has made us afraid of the stranger, afraid of the immigrant. We don't have a front porch anymore. We're all living in our backyards because we want to stay away from strangers. And you see this huge conversation about the strangers being dangerous. Well, the alternative leadership says, we need the stranger. I need somebody who sees the world differently than me. I'm desperate for that. Like-mindedness is an argument against democracy. It's an argument against community and care and faith and love and all the things that you stand for. And so the task is to have people be with people they know the least. So I would say a function of leadership towards the common good is to always group people with those they know the least, not with like-minded people. I will never be surprised by like-minded people. And so if I want to create with Malia a community and a place and respond to her desire to do something useful, and I totally identify with it. And it's not just millennials. I don't know of one person on earth that doesn't want their life to have meant something. And the problem is that we're all so individually minded that we tell Malia, it's up to you. And so to me, your gathering is to create an alternative to that. Say, we are here, connect with each other. And every time you talk, you should be talking to people you know the least and having conversations about what's the possibility we came here to create, not what's the problem we came here to solve. And you say, why don't we talk about what our gifts are? Why don't we talk about what we're good at instead of talking about what we're not good at? Even as individuals, I've been working all my life on my deficiencies. And there's a lot to work on. I have a lot of bad habits. And I'm 76 years old, and I've been working on it for 50 years. And it occurs to me, I've been working on the same damn deficiencies for 50 years. And I think, that's not going well. And every wife I have gives me the same feedback. Right? Every person I know, I could write a little manual if I ever was stupid enough to be with a new person, which I'm not. Playing it out with Kathy right now. This is it for life. But I could say, here's my deficiencies. Study them, because you're going to. So the idea is that working on deficiencies makes them stronger. Everything we declare war on gets strong. We declare war on terrorism, and terrorism is doing great. We declare war on drugs. Drugs are doing great. It's a growth industry, especially in Colorado and California. We declare war on poverty, and poverty is stronger now than it never has been. And so this whole notion of deficiencies, needs, war, let go of that. And with this, the alternative is to say, well, how do we come together in a small circle and talk about what we want to create together? Talk about what we're committed to. What I want to know about Malia is not so much that she came from Cincinnati, but I'm thrilled to hear that. or what she studied or what she's going to do. These are the I want to know, what is she committed to? What does she care about in this world? And to me, the Mennonites and the faith community has the strongest foundation to initiate that conversation in the world, because you stand for something. And every social movement I know of started in the faith community. So that becomes the work. And then you say, forget about the leadership style. Every time somebody complains to me about a patriarchal leader, I ask them the question, why are you creating that person in that way? The inmates do run the prison, and congregations decide what kind of leadership they want. And so if we keep saying, well, the leader is cause and the rest of us are effect, nothing will change. And you have, in your history and your capacity to care for each other and care for your own, you have the capacity and tradition to say, it's a communal solution. It's not a leadership solution. And I would say, let the leader be. You know, it's on us if we follow in some direction that makes no sense to us. And the methodology, that's very simple. You break people into small groups. Say, find somebody in this room that you know the least, because I only be surprised by the stranger. You're a community of hospitality. Hospitality is the welcoming of the stranger. You know how to do that. And then you create structures where it's the circle is powerful. And then the other thing you have to get over is being helpful. The dark side of a spiritual, faith-based, religious community is your helpfulness. As soon as you help somebody, you treat them as if they're somehow broken, or somehow need you. And you have people say, well, when I was your age, this is what I did. And it implies that it worked out well. And so anytime somebody says to me, when I was at this stage, here's what I did, I look at them, I say, yeah, look what happened. So the whole notion that what we did, so you get off this notion of I'm here to help you. I'm here to be with you. The most loving question in the world is not to ask somebody, what are you going to do? Or to give people advice. It's to ask the Malias of the world, what matters to you? Why does that matter to you? And so the challenge for the faith community is to replace help with curiosity. And then there's nothing to argue about. And if somebody takes a stance that makes no sense to you, you don't argue with the stance. You say, why is it important to you? Why do you care so deeply about that? And then when you hear why they care deeply, you realize there's more that binds us together than the argument we're having that keeps us apart. And the difference is, you say, let them exist in this community. We don't have to erase them. Some people will choose to leave or come and bless them in both directions. But that becomes a convening style of leadership to get people to talk about what's the possibility, what are we committed to, what gifts do we have, what gifts are we exchanging. I'm not going to learn about my gifts until it's too late. The only time people tell you your gifts is in a eulogy or when you retire. And I don't know why that is, but when you retire, they say nice things about you. And I think, well, where were you all those years when I was slogging through this? But I guess they say nice things because they're finally rid of you. And then I'm going to die, okay? And I know that. And I know when I die, there's going to be a little funeral, and it'll be a eulogy. And people will be lined up to forgive me. And they'll talk about my gifts. But I'm going to miss it. And it's a shame because I'm going to miss it just by a few days. So a communal form of leadership turns that around. It says every time we come together, the way we complete our being together is to say, here's what you've done that was useful. Because I don't know what I do that's useful to you. I have hopes and dreams and guesses, but I don't know. And I don't need a questionnaire. I don't need a Myers-Briggs questionnaire to tell me what my gifts are. I don't need a professional to tell me what my strengths are. I need you. I need you, after we've spent 20 minutes together, to say, Peter, you've done two things that have been useful to me, and they're always a surprise. And I have to hear them from you in the moment. And so it's a gift-minded, hospitality, embrace, circle-oriented form of leadership. And a form of using power. And of course, you need leaders, you need hierarchy, you need structure, because you need some order to get things done. But the way you use that power is to say, well, let's engage each other. And that serves the common good. The biggest cost of strong, quote, leadership is a deep isolation that we all live in. And there's no bigger task than to overcome that isolation. That without overcoming the isolation, the product is violent. And if you see the violence around us in our own world, our own community, the world at large, it's an outcome of a people's isolation and loneliness. And it's almost become institutionalized. And so whatever you're talking about, whether it's the schools, or whether it's a neighborhood, or whether it's the safety of a street, or the reawakening of faith, it's always a communal process that has to overcome isolation. If I'm going to find God, I find him in many places, one of which is in your eyes. And you understand that as a faith community, that it's the way you are, connect with each other. And it's really simple to do if you ask the right questions. If you say, what's important to you? Why was it important for you to come to this conference? What is it that you believe most in that you want to see embodied by our days together? It gets people connected. If I ask you, what's the crossroads that you're at this stage of your life? In 10 minutes, I will be closer to you than most other people in my life, especially if I don't try to be helpful. If you tell me your crossroads and I say, why does that matter to you? And I don't advise you, your faith is lived with that. It comes alive with that. That's why I like working with faith community, because you are together because you believe in something larger than yourself. It's just that the models of leadership we have don't embody that. They become patriarchal. You know, you're in a room now, the chairs I can see move. Now, why you line them up is the silliest thing in the world, you know. I guess it's the breed domesticity and docility in you. Keep you quiet, calm. But, you know, if I was in that room, the first thing I'd do is get all those chairs in a small circle. Because a small circle means you're facing the people you're going to create a life with. Right now, you're looking at a damn screen, you know. And so these are the structures that you begin to play with when you say what the communal kind of leadership whose first task is to overcome isolation. Every time I walk into a room, I've got to overcome my isolation. Because the pattern of life, the pace of life, the corporatization of life, the wish for control and predictability all gives me the feeling, two feelings. One, that I'm alone and I'm nuts. You know, the problem orientation says there's something wrong with you. Why don't you get it together? And but basically what community does, it tells you that you're not alone and there's nothing wrong with it. And that's where the faith community has a leg up on every other gathering in the world. It's because you have a belief system that says there's nothing wrong with it. And you're not alone and you're not crazy. I mean, you're not normal, but you're not crazy. And isolation breeds those three things. I think I'm crazy and there's something wrong with me and I'm destined to be alone. That's what, and so I see your gathering as an answer. I see the kind of leadership that Jim and David talk about. It's a response. So community is a response to isolation and the feeling there's something wrong with me. And when you come together, it's really, we're not alone. And even though it seems that way, there's nothing wrong with it. Nobody's here to be fixed. Anytime I help you, I colonized you. Every time I give you advice, I pretend that I know and you don't. So you decide for a day or two, let's just not give advice to anybody. Let's just get interested in it. And then that allows a leader to be a partner. A leader is somebody who's willing to care for the whole. And the leader's job is to raise questions of possibility and gifts and put people together. So it's a convening capacity. And it's not a role model capacity. Life is not a fashion show. We want our leaders to be role models. Role models of what? All I want the leaders to convene the group, put them in circles, and say, what are the questions we need to deal with? Probably. And then it's a leadership where you have it's dispersed and it's spread. How am I doing on my time? My 15 minutes of fame up? Let me get my watch.
You can easily take another 10 minutes.
Another 10 minutes, all right.
And 15 would be fine.
15 is fine. Okay, thank you. So let me get really practical about this. And the idea is you're trying to create an alternative narrative. And so I live into and live out of the story that I have about us and about the world. So my work in building community in Cincinnati is to try to create an alternative narrative. So Cincinnati has a narrative, unlike New York and the Golden City, that there's something wrong with us. I flew to Cincinnati, and they said, what are you doing here? You fall asleep on the bus? Did you run out of money? And so we have this kind of funny narrative that there's something wrong with us. So part of the work is to say we want to shift that narrative. And so all transformation is linguistic. So if I want to do something about poverty, let's say, or income inequality, first thing I do is I got to find a new language with which to speak. If you look at our schools now, where we turned our schools into centers for competition, and we want to race to the top, and no CEO left behind is kind of our pattern thing. And now we rank schools. And so in my city, which is largely African-American, we have failed school. And if you call something a failed school, it means the administrator and the teacher and the children are failing. They're not failure. If I call somebody poor, that doesn't describe a person without money is not a failure. They just don't have money. So the whole language of poor recreates what you're talking about. So I've got to change my language. Schools who don't do well on achievement tests mostly are low-income families. And so if you want to do something about the schools, you've got to do something about the income. If I want to do something about the income, I've got to find people and help people find out what they're good at and help them commercialize their gifts. As Malia said, she bought the program. She was told, if you go to school, incur all this debt, we have a job for you. Well, we don't. We do have a job for you. It's just the job is asking people whether they want French fries, they want ketchup on their fries. And so the world is going towards a more local, self-sufficient economy. It's the economy of the future. The jobs are not coming. We're going to bring textile manufacturing back to the United States, and they're going to employ 20 people. You know, we give these huge tax abatements. In Cincinnati, somebody just got a $500,000 tax abatement to expand their plant. And they're going to employ 8 people. So the notion, the old notion, there are jobs out there, if we let go of that. And so the alternative narrative is that we have to stop calling people according to their income level. We have to stop expecting schools to raise our children. We've outsourced the raising of our children. And we have to reclaim that. I have to know the names of all the children on my block. And I talk to people my age about education and say, oh, my kids are grown, I'm fine. No, you're not fine. These are all our children. And that's what a faith community has the potential to do. Is to create an alternative narrative. That's That's how religion got started, by somebody changing the story of who we are. And so whatever the issue is you care about, whether it's health, most of my health is dependent on my connection with my neighbor. 15% of my health is determined by the medical profession. 85% is either genes or my social engagement in the world. A friend of mine is a heart surgeon, and he doesn't want repeat business. He doesn't want to fix somebody's heart twice. And so I say, Paul, what do you do about that? He says, well, 6 months, we put them in a group. And if they go to group meetings, they are able to stay healthy. But if after we stop paying for those group meetings, and they're on their own, if they don't stay in a group, they don't have a chance. They're coming back. And the ones that have the least chance of coming back, who are most able to make the changes in their life they need to be healthy, run groups. And so community, groups, my connection to you is a major determinant of my health, not my doctor. And most of us don't tell the truth to our doctors anyhow. I go to the doctor, she says, 76 years old, how are you doing? I say, great. And she asks me whether I have any specific problems. I say, oh, no, everything's working fine. Everything's strong. I lie to her. I don't want her to know. I might have to do something about that. I want better living through chemistry. So whatever the domain, my health is dependent on my having a social group. If I join one group, and I'm active in the neighborhood, I'm going to live 1 year longer. And so the communal nature of who you are, of what you create. So wherever I go, I have to engage in a narrative of possibility, a narrative of speaking of connection, and overcome. And that's how we raise our children. Our children need to be raised in a circle, in a community. But can't let them be raised by the school. The school's doing everything it can. And same with safety. You live in a neighborhood that's not safe. Safe neighborhoods are ones where people are on the street. The police can't keep me safe. The doctor can't keep me healthy. The school can't raise my child. So all of these are things that are in motion now. And you see all kinds of community building. Community-mindedness, where people come together and they say, we can do for ourselves things that matter. We don't need professionals to do it any longer. We don't need systems. So the neighborhood becomes the center of possibility. We need food that's grown locally, sold locally. We need food that isn't exhausted from traveling 3,000 miles. And so this is the big movement that's happened that we're all a part of. It's a cooperative movement. The local movement, and the leadership role is to lift up and make these things visible and say, look, here's who we are. We are a possibility of a community where the possibility of gifts and capacities rather than deficiency, where the possibility of holding two ideas together and not letting it break us apart. And the political world wants to divide us. The dominant narrative is divide us. Are you for or against? Let's argue about gun control. Let's argue about gay marriage. Let's pass laws about that. All that does is break us into pieces. It says that if we see the world differently, we can't be together. And it's killing us. And so to me, your community is about restoring the common good. It's not about being right, but promising a certain future. It's to say, well, what do we have in common? What's the commons look like? And that's what the circle does. That's what your group does. It has the capacity to come together with people I know the least in conversations about what's the crossroads we're at. What do we say yes to that we no longer mean is a wonderful question. If you want to really have fun and get people connected, you ask them, what are you angry at that nobody knows about? These are intimacy-building conversations. And what they do is they change the context. So the context is one of generosity, one of gifts, one of possibility, one of intimacy, one of relatedness, rather than the context of control, consistency, predictability, efficiency. In my mind, the conversation of cost, speed, efficiency has no place in the church. Don't worry about it. Of course, you're going to be fiscally responsible, but it's not the point. And the last thought about the faith community is you have endowments. And most trustees' endowments have one purpose, and that's to make sure that thing doesn't shrink and make sure that endowment doesn't get used. And so we have all this kind of strange mentality as if the endowment was there to survive. There's a local church in Cincinnati that's got a $4 million endowment. You know what the trustees talk about? How many years can we last on this $4 million? 25 years, 30 years, 15? Wrong conversation. They should be saying, how can we use this $4 million to bring life into this community? We should be using this $4 million. We should be investing this in people nobody else trusts. And so all of these are shifting the conversation, and it's a leadership form that's communally based. And this culture is terrified of the word communal, communism. It's terrified of collective, co-housing. What is that? A bunch of hippies. And you have in your tradition a communal path, a caring path, egalitarian path. And it's just takes enormous intentionality to hold on to that in the midst of this divisive, patriarchal, high control, efficient, business-oriented, cost-oriented, speed-oriented. You come together for depth. You don't come together to do things quickly. And so that's why you import. That's why I need for you to do well. This is, we need places in this world that understand there is time, that depth matters, that relationship counts, that we can do things together, and that's the bias towards together. We can stop ranking our children. Right now, as soon as the kid goes into school, they go from a learner to a performer. And in the first grade, you put the normal curve over people's head and say, okay, now it's time to compete. If I'd had any integrity in school, I was a B student, I would have said, thank you to the D and F student. I would have said, you know, you failed in this class and made my B much easier to get. And I just want you to know I'm grateful for that. And there's another semester coming up. And if you wouldn't mind failing again, it's going to make my life much easier. So this is the context you're trying to change. We're not here to compete with each other. We're here to connect with each other. In that context, then you do your problem solving. You need to decide something, decide something. But you do it in the context of the relationship is the point, especially when it comes to that. So let me stop at that point. And David, or Roxy, you want to take us somewhere?
Thank you so much, Peter. So now what we're going to do is I'm going to invite Malia to come on up, and we'll have a conversation with both Malia and Peter.
Yes.
And the way that I want to structure this is, Peter, we had a conversation about this earlier. What the question we want to ask you is to think about and also talk with people next to you. What if we were to take Peter's comments seriously? So what if we were to really think about what does it mean to practice this third way of leadership, this new model, or you could call it an old model, or the model of convening. So leadership as convening, not necessarily as authority, but leadership as convening. Convening people in small groups, rejecting the notion of strangers, having conversations of possibility, and taking a stand and a place where people can exchange gifts, and the model of a circle instead of a kind of a hierarchy, but a circle. So what if we were to think of leadership as a convening function and that the relationship is the point? I really like the quote, every time I've helped you, I've colonized you. And I thought of that about leadership with. So think about that as that model of leadership. What would happen if we were to take those comments seriously and this third way seriously? So think about that yourself, and when you're ready, I'd invite you to take a few minutes to talk with your neighbor about that, and then we're going to open it up for a conversation with Malia and Peter. So talk with your neighbor. What if we were to take this model of leadership seriously? Yeah, this is Peter's dream of breaking down the rows into small groups. Okay, let's come back together. Let's come back together for our conversation with Peter and Malia. I will start with one of my own observations about taking this seriously. So there's a company called Zappos.com that sells shoes online, and they recently, I think, took this seriously where they now have a management structure called Holacracy, where they have no managers and all of their teams are organized literally in circles. And they call it Holacracy. And there's a consulting firm that will come and help you implement this. And they said, if you don't like it, if you prefer a traditional management structure, you're free to leave. And a bunch, some people did leave. They didn't like it. They couldn't handle working in that ambiguity. But they were taking it seriously because they thought it was more of an empowerment model to have people work in circles instead of in traditional teams. So that's just one example of it happening. But so what would be some of your comments, questions, and conversation for Peter and for Malia about this third way of leadership, this leadership as convening? And we have mics with Dave and over here.
Just might ask people what struck them about the conversation so far this morning.
Right, or what struck you? Yeah, okay, over here we have, I think the camera's panning over there.
Hi, Peter. My name's Rachel. Hi. Thank you so much for
starting. Hi, Rachel.
Hello.
Thank you for starting. You're a brave woman.
Well, thanks.
We desperately needed someone to stand up and say something. What you say doesn't matter. It's just the fact you stood up is everything.
It's just an icebreaker, right?
Thank God bless you. You can sit down now. Anybody else want to say anything?
Well, I do have one question that I'll ask.
Please.
You talked a little bit about the old model of leadership and this newer model of leadership. And I'm curious about how we make that transition to the new model of leadership when there are many generations represented in an organization where one generation might be used to the old model and then the newer generations are in this transition period getting used to a different type of model. So how does that transition work, taking everyone or helping everyone transition together and moving as a team and not being divided?
What do you lead, Rachel? What do you lead in the world?
What's the question?
What do you lead? What are you in charge of?
I am an admissions counselor at Goshen College.
And do you have a group that works with you?
I work with an admission, we have an admissions team, and I work specifically with high school students.
So every time you work with them, put them in a circle. You know, all of us are ambivalent about authority. We're all, it doesn't matter how young or old you are, you've been trained in a patriarchal way if you've been to school, because schools are organized like factories, and the kids are mostly lined up. And the teacher talks, and the students have to figure out how to please the teacher and pretend that they're learning. And so it's really not a generational thing. It's just that if you have an admissions group you're working with, you say, let's sit in a circle today and let's talk about what each of us has in mind for this gathering. And halfway through that gathering, so you just do it. You don't talk about doing it. And you don't say, some are ingrained. All of us have a patriarchal capacity. Sometimes it's useful in a crisis, but I would just say whatever room you're in, you suggest, let's stop for a second and let's talk about why we care about what we're doing here. Let's talk about what's the possibility, what do we want to create together, and let everybody's voice gets heard. And if it's too big a group, break them into groups of three or four. But I wouldn't want to think that some people are more authoritarian than others, because it's in all of us. And so you're really deciding together, let's come together and have a different kind of conversation. And if it's something that you run, then you say, I'm the leader, let's do it. You don't take a vote. You know, you say, well, today I want to have a conversation about what's the crossroads we're at in what we're doing. Let's talk about what we can agree on instead of spend all our time on what we disagree on. So anyway, thank you, Rachel, for starting us off. The question was much better than the answer. It's my fault.
All right. Back there.
One takeaway that I have was just what was implicit was leadership and living where respect isn't earned, it's given. It just is.
Yeah.
We come with a self-respect of ourselves and others. I don't know that there's a new or old binary relationship conversation here. I think it's just a reawakening of what are our ethics?
Yeah. Who do I want to be right now?
Yeah, and that shapes so much then of who we say others are, and it shifts us from a politics of conversion to an ethic of respect. That's proof texting John Brown Child's book on transcommunality, which is a great read, but you should do it as a group. Respect comes to mind as sort of a takeaway, and as a foundation for leadership and keeping the circle moving. The absence of respect is quite an experience, and I think a lot of us in church structures know what that feels like these days.
We do. You know, the absence of respect is the loss of faith in each other. And it's easy to have faith in God. It's hard to have faith in the people sitting across the room. In my mind, you all are in this room. Reaffirm and deepen your own faith in each other. Beautiful statement. Thank you. Now, nobody wants to follow that. Anybody like to say something trivial and silly? Yeah, there we go. Give us your name.
My name is Annetta Miller. I live in Nairobi, Kenya. You sound so African, I must say. And I would just like to throw, I'm a paramiographer.
A what?
A paramiographer, a collector of proverbs. And I would like to just throw in two African proverbs. One is, I am because we are. We are because I am.
Yeah.
And the other proverb, if you want to walk fast, walk alone. If you want to walk far, walk with others.
Yeah.
And you made a very important point about walking with others and not walking fast.
Yeah. Time is a construct. We're not that busy. Half the things I do don't mean anything. I just find myself doing them. It is possible to go to a meeting and leave without a list. A friend of mine is a mayor of Palo Alto and a city manager. And he says the purpose of problems are to give us an excuse to be together. All right? We don't come together to solve problems. We have problems as an excuse to be together. And maybe being together is the point. And if being together becomes the point, the problems get solved very quickly. And we're all sons and daughters of Africa. Of course we are. But we have that in our culture too. You have it in your culture. You have the beauty about faith community is you value silence. You just call it prayer. and you value time. You have time to be with each other. And you have something called the Sabbath, which is a political act. And it's a stance against restless productivity. It's a stance against every producing. A friend of mine, Walter Brueggemann, is an Old Testament scholar. And he said that when baseball started wanting to play games on Sunday, the Sabbath, the way they did it was to give all the ministers in town free seats for the baseball game. And so the Sabbath is a stance that says we need one day a week. God needed it. We need one day a week to rest, to have thought, to remember, to have a memory. Modernism erases our memory. It gives us amnesia. So all those, the proverbs you're saying are beautiful. The challenge is to act them out together. And it is slower. I've got, you know, all the time in the world. And, Malia, you still around?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Okay, another question, go ahead. You speak up too.
Hi, my name's Lori, and I appreciate your focus on transformation and possibility and moving us away from just simply solving problems. And I wondered if you could speak to what happens alongside of this gathering together, the dialogue, the circle process. A lot of that can be how we do our work. And in many organizations, we still have a very, very strong culture that exists alongside of it, and that's accountability. Evaluation processes. In the end, what do you suggest for those processes to support the solving of problems?
Exactly. That's my answer. We do. We have funny little habits. We have these protocols of patriarchy, like an annual performance evaluation is the dumbest thing ever invented by human beings. All it does is say, I'm going to sit down one day with you and remind you that I own you. Any question? You know, because you're just going to tell me, you know, so you have to change them. And if you want to create those protocols are supposed to create accountability, but they let people off the hook. See, patriarchy does not hold people accountable because you can't hold them all the time. Sooner or later, I got to take my hand off your arm. The circle is a people don't like the circle because it's fierce accountability. I'm accountable to my peers. And my peers don't put up with a lot. My boss does. I know how to manipulate my boss. It's the easiest thing in the world. My boss gives me feedback and I say, thank you very much. I'm working on it. And you raise your arm to him. And so I know how to manipulate my boss. Thanks. Sure. I'm your man. Peers don't put up with that. And the reason is, so everything you said is brilliant. And you're creating a bubble of community inside a world of patriarchy and all of its habits. And I don't fight patriarchy. You just say, let's create a circle in the world that I can touch. And then if you do it, I'll do it, and they'll do it. That's how movements get started. But you don't talk. And then if you're in HR, you have some, every time you have a voice over some of these patriarchal structures, you say, let's try something different because they're not working. That's the beauty of it.
My name is Ruth Jost. A question for Malia.
Thank you.
You gave us a picture of your connectedness and community and the way you generate that and live in it. And of course, we've all had ways of staying in a world of the people we feel most comfortable with, and obviously there's a huge opportunity to do a lot of that for millennials and others. But so I'm curious to know, what are the ways, I mean, given that we all are so connected with our devices and maybe doing less face-to-face, but even in a face-to-face world, people can stay face-to-face with people like them. So I'm wondering, when we're living our lives through devices, especially in your generation, what are the arenas or the ways that you see people using that to, well, to realize the dream of it maybe, which is to connect people across all kinds of lines. What do you in your life see? And I'm an illiterate social media person. Don't do it. And face to face is more than I can, you know, I don't have time for all the face to face. So I would be really interested to know how do you use it beyond what you described and, you know, the idea of convening for leadership purposes? And can you just fill in a picture of that for me, either what you see happening or would like to see happening or would like to do more of?
Okay, so just to clarify, you want to know about how we use social media to do kind of that face-to-face interaction, but on the internet?
No, not to do face-to-face, but to break out of the world of people who are like me and that I'm close to and I'm based with, which is an important connection and that we all ground our lives in. And I see you doing it, and I'm wondering, in what ways do you see doing this other thing across difference? And
Maybe the question for Malia is, where do you find strangers?
No, I think she described her base of strength very well. And
strangers.
Oh, I see. Gotcha.
How do you use social media to connect with people who are different from you?
Okay. So basically social media has several features that allow you to meet different people. So for me, having conversations with people on comments are one of the main things I find strength in. I feel that I have a voice, and I feel like we're all equal. There's no way to be in a hierarchy at that point, because every comment is the same. It looks all plain and simple, and you basically can have conversations there that enabled you to express what you're feeling without that almost that pushback of, oh, you're wrong, because I mean, most likely you're not going to get a direct response right then and there. And so that's one of the things that has enabled me to talk to other people who are slightly different than me and to find out what exactly they're thinking, and being able to do it in a safe environment almost, where you can be slightly more radical, which is sometimes bad, but it's just the way it is, and I see it going towards a way that we're using it for social issues, and we're using it to combine people, even if they're not like-minded, and making a better solution, and going towards that solution. I hope that answered your question.
Hi, my name is John. Thank you, Peter. I'm wildly enthusiastic about your presentation this morning.
Thank you.
A question. Many people have been traumatized. I'm thinking of traumatized children, Syrian refugees, the Holocaust.
Us.
The Holocaust.
I said us, too.
Us, too. Yeah. All of us. I mean, we have been frustrated in some part of our lives, deeply. And how does this... Such people have experienced the power of power. They have been abused. And they are often very, very reluctant to give up power. And in a circle, we don't have power other than the power of our peers. So my question is, how do you deal with people who have a real need, a deep-seated psychological, social need for power, who do not want to give up control because never again. This must never happen to them again. How do you invite them into a circle?
You know, that's a beautiful question. You know, a stance is, if you argue with me, I'm warning you now, I'm going to take your side. You know, I would never have an argument about power. I would just get curious about it. People say, we need a leader, we need control. You know, get rid of this circle, this touchy-feely crap. I didn't come here to sit in a circle. I came to get something done, and you're wasting my time. And my response to them is, good point. period. Good point. So I just go with it and not let them not, you know, if you argue with it, and you just say, I understand you don't like this circle, but we still want you to sit with us. And if they can express the fact they don't like it, and they'll have a story about it, you know, everybody has a story to justify their stance. I know that the stories are just fiction. Now, people are abused in life, but it's the story I make up about it that's decisive. And so I'm not very much into listening much to people's stories because I know it's just a construction, something they made up. I want to know, what are you committed to? What do you care about? And some people are abused, and the idea of never again is a conversation with God. You know, people say, why is there such suffering in the world? Nobody has an answer for that. Talk to God. So the key is to have compassion for their suffering, but not to be controlled by the conclusions they've drawn from the suffering. Because a lot of people suffer a lot. And are the most open-hearted, you know, collaborative, communal people in the world because of their suffering. And I just don't, you know, in my community, you know, which I'm a Jew. And we go back and forth about this all the time. And it's distressing to see so much of my community still so frightened to join the rest of the world and to find peace in places. But, so you have to understand it. I don't want to let that be decisive. And I don't want to argue with anybody. People say, this is baloney. This is the dumbest thing I ever heard. I wrote a book on empowerment. Somebody called me on the phone from Kansas and said, I've been forced to read this book for a class. I'm living in Connecticut. And he said, this is the dumbest book I've ever heard in my life. I'm not going to read this book. I'm tearing it up. I mean, he went on. And I just got a little nervous, of course. One, that he found me. And the other was, I just said, go for it. Tear it up. Thank you for calling. You know, you just can't respond in kind. And you know that. Your faith knows that. Your tradition knows that. And so also when people are wounded, like I deal with a lot of people in Cincinnati who don't know where they're sleeping tonight. And I just not interested in that. I don't ask them, have you been to jail? I don't ask them, do you know where you're sleeping? I say, what do you love to do? How do you want to spend this time? What are you good at? So I don't want to treat that person as if that's who they are, because I know it's just a story. Their transformation will come at the moment they realize they can live into a different story than the one that got me here. And to me, that's what therapy is about. It's what community is about. It's what healing is about. Since you come to this conference, say, now what's the story we want to live into together? Because it means then that we're free, that we're committed to something larger. And the story doesn't have to be decisive. And usually the stories require forgiveness. The great question is, what's the forgiveness you're unwilling to offer?
Hi, Peter.
Somebody in the front, this woman right there, has been raising her hand 5 times and now she's given up. I'm feeling sorry for her. Go ahead. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, Tony.
Oh. Hi, Peter. My name's Tony, and thank you so much for being here with us.
Was it useful?
It was inspiring and useful.
Okay. I like inspiring.
I do too. As so it turns out, I teach in the MBA program, and I teach a course on stewardship, innovation, and social innovation. So I've been following your work for quite
Thank
some
you.
Time. My background is in architecture, and my co-conversant, Michael, also, as it turns out, has a background in architecture. So I have a question for you about design.
Yes.
I was trained in the Beaux-Arts tradition, where the architect stares into his or her navel and comes up with a beautiful design. from that moment on, I rejected that patriarchal model and started to practice more in the way of social architecture. And the question I have for you is, would you have some practical suggestions regarding co-designing the future with small groups? What kinds of questions should a small group ask about the preferred future in terms of developing and designing that future? And I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Hey, Peter, this is Roxy. So you have 2 minutes to answer this question, just to give you a time frame, because we actually need to break at 5 till.
Okay. You know, it is a question of design, a question of architecture. Even the room, first thing you can do is to say, let's re-inhabit this room. Let's decide how we want to be together in this room, no matter what the architect had in mind. So everywhere I go, I'm always rearranging furniture. That's what I do for a living, and create circles. The questions, you know, are, what's the crossroads we're at? What are we good at? What do we care most about? What's the possibility we want to live into? What's the promise I want to make? Regardless of whether anything come back in return. What do I want to say no to? What am I upset with nobody knows about? What gifts do we have in this room? All of these are architectural design questions that open up space for new possibilities, for an alternative future. The thing that will never get you an alternative future is talking about problems, doing another study. You know, there's a great tendency in the faith community to look to the Bible for answers, but we create the Bible by the way that we read it. And so I think, you know, your question is really the answer. It is a design question, and how we sit together, the questions that we take up with each other determine what we leave with. And I feel that social architecture and physical architecture are almost one and the same thing. And the physical architecture, say, how do you create rooms that have life in them? And Christopher Alexander, of course, is the genius of that. But thank you for that question. As soon as you ask the question that way, it takes you somewhere, even that question.
Well, thank you so much, Peter and Malia, for your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for having me, and just blessings to you all. I hope you have a great session together.
Thank you so much. So now we're going to go to our flag-raising ceremony to celebrate. It's the Ori Miller Center flags that we're going to be raising down in the University Commons. So you're going to head down that way, and it's a chapel ceremony. We have chapel on Fridays at 10, so we're going to be having a chapel ceremony, so we're all headed down that way, and then you're going to come back up here as soon as that's finished for refreshments that are going to be up here. So head on down there as soon as you can, because it's going to start in a few minutes.